From KVLU Public Radio in Beaumont, Texas, this is Bayoulands Talks, a companion podcast where we're sharing some of our favorite conversations with a wide range of guests that we've interviewed for the KVLU radio documentary series Bayoulands, a program exploring the people and places of Southeast Texas since 2016. I'm Shannon Harris. For this episode, we're sharing a conversation from the very first episode of Bayoulands in 2016. It's an interview Jason M. Miller did with artist Stephanie Dwyer upon the unveiling of her bottle tree sculptures in the Children's Garden at Shangri-La Botanical Gardens and Nature Center in Orange, Texas. We hope you enjoy.
So first, thank you for talking to me on KVLU today.
Stephanie. Thanks for having me.
Well, I appreciate it. I really wanted to start a bit after doing a little reading beforehand. And sometimes I don't feel like I do enough, so I hope that you enlighten me on these things. But I wanted to just ask you first, where did you grow up?
That'd be San Bernardino, California until I was about six.
Okay.
And then my dad got a wild hair. He was a California highway patrolman, and he went to college and became an accountant, of all things, and then wanted to go hunting.
Okay.
So we moved to the Pacific Northwest.
Okay.
And from there, I went to multiple different schools, and my family, my parents divorced when I was in the fifth grade.
Okay.
And my retreat was always the woods because they fought a lot.
Right.
So, I was a, tadpole catching kid. That kid with the jar of tadpoles, that was me.
Yeah. So, yeah, I was immersed in nature, right?
Yeah, and very observant. You know, remember when The Wizard of Oz, watching that as a kid, and you see the big trees come to life and they hit the back of, I think it was a scarecrow.
Yeah.
And so in my mind, I remember you always were cautious of strangers and whatnot. And I said, nobody's going to get me in these woods. All these guys are going to protect me. And now it's weird because I'm building these trees that I feel that I have a connection with. Yeah. And I think somewhere in my youth, the seed was planted in my head, just the appreciation for nature and trees in general.
Yeah.
And I think that's with like these large trees, if you look to me, they look like they just kind of sprouted up there on their own.
Yeah. I find that always interesting because it seems like when people that are working with nature, inspired by nature in some form, which I'm sure we all are, I'm always interested in what landscape people take in. Because some people it's the ocean or the desert, something vast. And then I'm always fascinated though, because I kind of always leaned in those areas or like an open space. But I'm always been fascinated by people that are inspired by like the forest, because it seems to me like there's a comfort in the enclosure of it. Mm-hmm. And then also maybe the detail of it. Because somebody that's focusing on like a broad desert landscape, it seems like they look at maybe the sky and the horizon, but then somebody in the forest is going to look down at something very small on the ground. And is that something that you were drawn to too? As you kind of worked with what this felt like?
I never even thought about that before, but if you think about it, just being here on the property, they gave me access to the back roads and whatnot that the public can't see.
Yeah.
Well, when you go back on those bayou roads, you know, Mr. Stark built that roadway back there, and it's taller than the bayou, so he could drive his truck back there. Well, here I am going in the golf cart, and there's this sense of peace.
Yeah.
Quiet.
Yeah.
And there's just too much in the world going on for the average human being to take in, I think. Yeah. And we all need that space where we feel comfort and safety and a sense of space. Like, I'm very aware of my surroundings.
Yeah.
And I never knew I was an artist until I took the welding course. And I knew I always had a connection. I was always building things, you know, even as a kid. But I think that we all seek out that outlet, whether it be people who are drawn to the desert or people who are drawn to the ocean. But it's your happy place.
Yeah.
For some reason, you don't know why, you're drawn to that.
Yeah.
And I think that I'm definitely drawn to secluded areas, not a lot of human contact. I need that. You know, there's a balance. Like coming here, I've had how many interviews today? And I'm, you know, I had no idea there were going to be this many, but
I'm
overwhelmed with the human contact. But you also, you know, like dealing with those students, I feel like I have a responsibility to them. I'm telling them information because I feel like we all cross paths for a reason. So in this conversation, I might say something that you will think about a month down the road, and you know, somehow it'll make sense that these people are like puzzle pieces in your life.
Yeah.
You know, and they're exposing you to new things. And so those kids, I hope they walk away with a sense of some new welding techniques that I shared with them. And you know, and I told them all they can contact me down the road, especially if they're wanting to get into the arts, because I learned the hard way doing the art shows and whatnot. It is grueling. Yeah. So if you ever see an artist in an art show, an art fair, or whatever, treat with them with the utmost respect.
Sure.
And don't barter with them. Do not talk them down on price, because they put their heart and soul into this, and you're just degrading them, I feel. You're devaluing their gifts.
It's like what you said. It kind of takes me to a place I'd like to talk about, but kind of backtracking that step and say, was there anyone like you're thinking about you passing on information to these kids for you in the arts, mentor or another artist or somebody that inspired you creatively that you knew growing up? That maybe they said something and it clicked later with you.
Oh, my grandfather. Who I was named after. He was the closest one in my family, the person I was closest to.
Yeah.
And he had an accent. He's from Chicago, and the whole family's Polish. So he says, instead of think, he would say tink, and put your money in the bank. Always, you know. Anyway, he had a tin can in the backyard, and he'd stuff it with money because he went through the Depression.
Yeah.
So that got stuck in my head, you know, that I'm going to have a tin can of backup money, which never happens. But let's see, what did he say? If you start something, you finish it.
Yeah.
You know, that's just the key. If you start something, you finish it.
Yeah.
And that has stood out in my mind more than anything anybody's ever told me.
What were some of the first things that happened with that you started and you know you need to finish it as far as artistic work?
Oh, wow.
Maybe it was something that seemed daunting at the beginning, or maybe it was one of your first ones, or...
Yeah, well, here's what happens in the process. Okay, so when you're building, say I'm building a gate for someone.
True.
And I have a sketch of how that gate's supposedly supposed to look, but I also have artistic license to change it up a little bit because it's not going to look like the sketch.
Right.
And I might add some more things or embellishments. So starting that, and then you get to a point where if it's too taxing, where I'm like, because I'm going to give them my best. I'm not just going to go build something just to make money and build it. So I'm like, okay, I've got to walk away from this piece. And I've done that a lot. I've walked away from something. The first bottle tree I did out there, I had the biggest struggle ever because the pressure of replacing those old trees with my trees was huge, because I want to respect, you know, the look that they had, the history with those trees in particular.
Right.
And they were using cedar that deteriorated. And so I was like, man, I've got to do equal or better, you know, to complement this space. So that was a huge pressure.
Yeah.
But then I got over it. I mean, I'm really proud of them. I really like them. It's one of those pieces that I've done where I can walk away and feel that, you know what, there's nothing I would change on it. I'm happy with them. They have their own personality. And why would you want to change? You know, I look at them as living beings. You know, you look at them as metal structures. And I feel like, you know, we have a connection. You know, those are my girls.
What is the bottle tree itself? Is there a specific background or history to that?
Yes, it's, you know what, it's
work, or
yes.
I'm looking for the word that,
well, it's
or...
funny because when they asked me, you know, someone asked me to do a bottle tree years ago, it's 2007.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what one was. You know, I moved to Mississippi from Washington State, and I had been through some really challenging situations up there in a relationship, and I had to get out of the state just to get a new life and detach from that. And I brought all that trauma with me. So I put all of that loss and sense of self-doubt into metalworking. And like, anyway, somebody asked me to build a bottle tree. My aunt lived in the Delta. She drove me around. We looked at trees, and I was like, that is the ugliest thing I've ever seen. I mean, I would see just rebar, stiff, straight, no imagination, just, You know, are they trying to dry those bottles? Is that what's going on here? And then I said, you know what? And then my aunt told me the folklore behind it, and that is that African Americans brought it to the United States. Although some claim that, you know, bottle trees have been around for thousands of years, in the United States, we're talking about African Americans who actually brought that tradition, because it sure wasn't the Pilgrims.
Sure.
Yeah. So anyway, the idea, the concept is, like voodoo or mysticism, we have haints, or bad spirits that, you know, bring bad juju. There's good juju and bad juju, and this brings bad juju. And if you put these bottles on the trees outside your home, the haints or spirits are drawn to the end of these bottles, and then by the morning light, they're destroyed and or trapped in the bottle. So that was a superstition. And back in, I think it was the 50s in particular, or 40s, combination of 30, 40, and 50, I think, was the big milk of magnesia bottles, you know, blue milk of magnesia.
Yeah,
and so you would see the Delta landscape littered with these bottles. And so this is the modern day version of that, the blue bottles.
Where do you find the bottles nowadays?
We drink a lot.
Drink a lot.
Riesling.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. I order my
a lot
bottles.
Of milk and magnesia. Does it come in a?
Well, you know what?
They can't afford glass anymore, right? It's got to be plastic.
It is plastic now. Yeah. The blue bottles, these ones in particular, came from a bottling distribution company in Portland. So, like home brewers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And there's two different styles of blue bottles that you can get. So.
Okay.
Buy them by the case, no labels. And then the smaller bottles, you've got your platinum beer, you know, Bud Light Platinum.
Yeah, yeah.
And that sticker.
Yeah, you got that.
I'm a pro at taking stickers off bottles now.
With no residue left. That's
exactly,
cool.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's cool.
But you look at the glass, you know, when you look at bright colors and what, like paintings, they stir in you something. I can look at a collage or something and I'm drawn to that or not. You know, depending on the colors they use, the shapes they use. And I think that the same goes with bottles. I mean, a lot of people are like, I never would have thought about putting bottles on a tree. That's amazing. And it's just, it's kind of like having color in your garden year round. You know, it's almost like a big bloom or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And it plays into all the colors from the other flowers and things in there too.
It just kind of fits in nature.
Yeah, it's kind of fits in nature.
And then it kind of goes hand in hand with recycling.
Yeah.
You know, that's the appeal with a lot of people is to know that they're recycling. So that's one more notch in your belt for doing something good for the environment, you know?
How has the bottle tree adventure taken your work in traveling? Is that it? Do you do a lot of those? Has that been a primary fixture of your work since 07?
You mean the traveling?
Yeah, or just the bottle tree, making the bottle trees.
Oh.
Yeah, of being part of what you do. I was kind of wondering if it took
it's
off.
It's funny because I want to write a book.
Yeah.
And that book would be based on, I would call it My Bottle Tree Adventures, I think.
Okay.
Because since day one of doing the bottle trees, it has been a way for me to meet people that I would never have met normally.
Yeah.
And it's very neutral ground. And I've said this so many times, we are all very different. We all have different beliefs. We have different political beliefs, religious beliefs, you know. You set all of that aside, and you're just observing this sculpture, you know, together. Or here's a good example of bottle trees. I call it like a bottle tree club.
Yeah.
My example was, if I'm driving, because I drive over 30,000 miles a year delivering trees and gates and whatnot. If I'm traveling down the road and I see a bottle tree in someone's yard and my truck is broken down, I'm going to that house for help. Because that person's got to have some element of cool to them. You know, it's like we're part of a club.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then the people that are drawn to bottle
You got a
trees,
nice in though, because you're going to be like, I'm a bottle tree artist as well.
I'm the pusher.
I know who you got that bottle tree. I know them. Or did you do it? Yeah.
Well, you know what? The most flattering thing I've ever heard is when I did art shows, and I would have these elderly ladies who have the background of the bottle tree. These are Southern women, decadent women. And for a long time, bottle trees were considered, you know, hodgepodge, kitschy, not something you would have in your yard, tacky. Okay. And so women would come into my booth and I would hear them say, I would never have a bottle tree in my yard. But they said, but I could do this one. And that's when I went, yes. That when you hear that, you're like, I'm doing good.
They're
work
on board. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. And you mentioned gates too. What kind of gates do you do, and do you still make those? And was that something you started out
with? I'm working on a gate right now, actually, and garden panels, gates. I have a friend who does fused glass, so I incorporate her glass into my pieces.
Okay.
So right now I'm working on a dragonfly gate. So it has, I have a certain style that I do. I love the flow of tendrils, like vine tendrils. You know, when they're reaching out and they're grabbing and they're twisting around something, that's new life and growth.
Yeah.
And so I incorporate those into my gates. So you do the gate framework, which is standard, like a square tube. And then in the middle, I'll have a glass medallion. And I'll either have perching birds or I'll have dragonflies or butterflies. And then in the piece, the framework of the piece, or actually the skeletal part, will be these tendrils coming up. And they're wrapping around the framework, taking that form of the gate and making it a little more organic looking, not just so much, not so structural.
Yeah. That's
and linear.
That's yeah. And with the bottle trees, and people are talking, people come see where, you know, those here in Southeast Texas to come by Shangri-La and see your work here. But what's the process like to make that? How long does it take? And what are some of the steps you have to do?
Well, you know, what's funny is like when you look at the trees, you just go, it's just, oh, it's a tree, but with me, it's like, it's layers and layers and layers, and it was a lot of foraging, and it was working with really heavy material. The thickest material was 1¼ inch solid rod. Okay. So you've got rolled material, it's round, and we used a 3-foot propane forge with 6 burners. So you're getting a more consistent heat for 3 feet of length. The forge we started out with was 12 inches. So you're only getting that short of a heat. So you're not getting that nice fluid bend that you see in the trees with the shorter heat. You need that longer heat. But anyway, we were using locking clamps, and I had an assistant who's a pretty burly guy. And by the end of these days, we couldn't even lift our arm to turn on the light switch.
Sure. Yeah.
We were spent. We were tired. And you've got a lot of torquing and lifting. And it took 6 people, 6 of the landscape crew, to actually lift just the trunks, not the limbs and everything, just the bare trunk. And that was welded to a platform, a plate. And then they had to put that plate on top of bolts that were coming out of the concrete, so they had to match those up. So that was another, you know, nail biting, you know.
Sure.
So yeah,
you're kind of directing that, and kind of okay, I can see.
Yeah, once we got the trunks up, it's almost like I just want to go. Okay, let's go home.
Yeah, that's way. I'll do the rest later.
Yeah,
tomorrow.
Can I come back?
Until tomorrow.
Yeah, but no, they worked out really good, and everybody here was really helpful. And the plan was I was going to do this in 4 weeks. I thought, oh, a week a tree, or, you know, that.
Yeah.
No, heck no. So, and I'm afraid of heights, and I had to use a scissor lift. Ooh. And the first tree, I was just drilling, you know, and I was right up there with the birds, and birds kept coming in the tree while I'm welding, going, I'm like, really? You know, and I think there's some concept in that. If you're up in the air, you're less of a threat as a predator. You know, when, as a human, when you're on the ground, then you're the predator. So here I am up there. I mean, lizards were coming up and just hanging out with the big throat thing going on, and, you know, the mating dance, I guess it was. And I was like, I'm not your kind. But it was a really good experience. But I think that with these trees, I'm really honored and flattered to represent a part of our American, I guess, folklore and iconic history to the South. There's not a lot of people in the North. You know, you would never typically see a bottle tree in the North during the 50s. That's not, you know, it just kind of flowed. People who experienced it would take that up North. And so it was predominant in the South. And now the Smithsonian, we've been in the works communicating for 3 years now, and they want me to do, we're thinking two large scale trees for the entrance to the cultural exhibit, which is indoor exhibit, which means I can use mild steel and not the Corten steel. And the Corten steel is a little more brittle to work with, so that mild steel will be easier. And I think I'll be forging the trunk and the limbs at home, transporting, and then probably renting shop space at the Smithsonian. But the thing I love about the Smithsonian is they do recognize bottle trees as being significant to African American history in our nation. Okay. And I don't know, I think I've always, because I heard the folklore from the beginning, I had a sense of honor in what I was doing.
Right.
And whereas people were just, bottle tree, used to it, been there, done that, seen it all my life.
Yeah.
And now here's little Stephanie coming in. Well, if I just tweak it a little bit,
you know?
And so now it's become this, I've sold over 2,000 trees.
Wow.
Yeah. I shouldn't say sell. Right. I've made over 2,000 trees.
Made. Okay.
I've gifted a lot of trees to people. Oh, cool. Just, you know, if you, that's the beauty about being an artist. If someone moves you in some way, the best gift to give them would be an extension of yourself.
That's great. The Smithsonian opportunity is, that's what, when is, when does that process start, and when is it going to tentatively be ready there?
Well, late October, early November, I'm flying up there for about 3-4 days.
Okay.
I'm going to take it all in, take measurements, and then talk to them. I have to talk to them, to their architects, about, you know, what's behind the walls, because it has to harness to the walls. These trees won't have a plate on the floor.
Okay.
So it's going to look like they're growing up out,
out of the floor. Okay.
And then, so they want it installed by June of next year.
Wow.
Yeah, and I just want to take my time. And like the trees here, they just kind of let me know what they want to do.
Yeah.
You know, and it's funny, if you're in the environment, for instance, here, you've got that Gothic greenhouse that's the backdrop to the trees.
Yeah.
There again, it's like, you know, as an artist, I'm not ever going to be that artist that it's all about me. It's not. You're working with your environment, because I want these to look as organic as possible. So that greenhouse, just the architectural style of it with the pitched gable and just the design of it, the trees complement that. If that wisteria arch wasn't between the two, and it was winter and all that greenery was gone, you'd see that if you were looking through the trees, they're complementing that greenhouse in the backdrop, not working against it.
Against it, yeah. That's great. I get to work off that space. An interesting space here. Well, what has been, just talk a little bit about your experience here at Shangri-La. I mean, it's, you got to drive back there, and one thing that always fascinated
me.
You got the golf cart into the marsh. One of the things that always amazed me about it is when I first learned about it, it's amazing that a fairly busy street is just over this wall. It's kind of cool.
And not just any wall. That's a brick wall.
Yeah.
With the water, the natural sound of water drowning out the white noise of traffic right behind that wall.
Yeah.
How cool is that?
Yeah.
Even cooler aspect, that brick wall, they built it to respect the natural environment. There's a tree. I don't know if you've seen it, but they built the brick wall around the tree limb. So there's a hole with the tree limb coming through. Who does that?
Yeah.
You know, arrogant man usually just, I'm going to cut that thing
off. We'll cut that thing down, and then nature will take it back eventually, and we just scoff at that. But that's amazing they did that. How much space this is, how far it goes back into the town of
acres.
Orange. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, looking that overhead and seeing that, yeah.
Well, when they invited me out here, it was April of last year, and they flew me out here to look at the space, and I got here. But, you know, from the airport to here, I'm driving around Orange, and I'm like, what the?
Where is this thing? Where is this thing? Yeah. Yeah, where were they going to put the garden?
I
see a lot of parking lots. Yeah, I know.
The minute you drive up to that gate, and it's a metal, that one component in the gate is all metal, a saw palmetto and some natural grasses. And I was like, ooh. And then the wood that they use, all the cypress. And then you do that film as you walk into Shangri-La, the introductory film. Have you done that? Did you know? I almost cried.
Yeah.
The curtain goes up and
you see, and you see that back there. I know. It's a dramatic thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's it's like an oasis in the middle of Orange. And so I was, well, it's great to hear your experience on that, because I couldn't not imagine that you saw, well, I'll get to work off this space that was something that was appreciated.
Well, you know, too, is when Mr. Stark was here, you hear all these stories about how he would lock himself in here and just, you know, this was like his getaway, his oasis, his playground, you know? And so when I'm going through those back roads, it's, I don't know, I feel like just, you know, when you had a grandfather that you absolutely adored and he passed away, but you always feel his presence.
Yeah.
That's how I felt when I was here. Yeah. Like, I feel like if he could be up in heaven or wherever, and he was aware that I was building these, that he would be honored. You know, he would be proud of me for doing it.
Yeah. And it would be something that would be adding to
his vision.
His vision, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Stephanie, thanks for having this talk today.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. And we look forward to visiting the trees here at Shangri-La many times. Thank you.
Yeah. Can I suggest something?
Sure.
Okay, for the public, if you come see the trees, if anybody is so bold, there's this strip of grass right between two of the trees. Lay down in it and look up.
Okay.
I'm not kidding. I want to see people do that. I want pictures of that.
I'm gonna go do
that's
that.
That's the you just, best view you just of the
gave me,
tree.
I'm gonna do that. You just gave me a perspective.
Right,
let's all do that right now. You just gave me a perspective on that. It's like that that spot in the theater to sit in or whatnot. It's that special spot. Yeah, that vantage point.
And it's part of the Bottle Tree Club.
Yeah, it is.
You gotta lay under a bottle tree and look up at the sky, and then you're in, like Flynn.
Yeah, this is folklore we're talking about. You have to. There's a special way to do this. Yeah. Yep. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
No, thanks for having me.
Our thanks to artist Stephanie Dwyer for that interview. And we did take Stephanie's advice. At the close of the interview, we lay down on the grass and looked up at the bottle tree sculptures. The Children's Garden at Shangri-La recently opened back up to visitors, so you can see the bottle trees for yourself. To learn more, go to shangrilagardens.org. Bayou Lands Talks is produced in the studios of 91.3 KVLU Public Radio in Beaumont, Texas, by Shannon Harris and Jason M. Miller. For more information and to stream KVLU online, visit kvlu.org. And remember to share and subscribe to Bayou Lands Talks wherever you find your podcasts. You can also listen on NPR One, along with other podcast offerings from KVLU Public Radio. And join us on social media at Bayou Lands on Instagram and 91.3 KVLU Public Radio on Facebook.